This was progress. A minute later, I found a door that led outside. As I stepped over the threshold, my lungs expanded with a breath of fresh, pine-scented air. I closed my eyes, raising my face to the sky. So many months had passed. I hadn't realized how much I'd missed sunlight and crisp, clean air. Swallowing the lump in my throat, I left the abbey behind. The snow was mostly melted, with patches left here and there in the shade. A copse of budding fruit trees led to a thin river that gurgled over smooth stones and disappeared into tall grass. I wanted to be out of sight, and not too near dried sticks or bracken. Under a spindly tree, a few flat rocks lined the riverbank, probably to pile clothes on for washing when it was warm enough. I laid the scraps on the rocks. The morning I had donned them had been the worst day of my life. Although I'd pushed away the memories when I was awake, it invaded my mind every night. I couldn't wipe out the vision of what had happened, but I could destroy this reminder. I held my palms toward the pile and closed my eyes. Heat pooled in concentric rings around my heart. Let it build. Patience. Steady. Just as Grandmother taught me. Wait until it's ready to spit forth, then harness and control it. Controlling it had never been my strength. I called up every hot urge and feeling that had sat under my skin for months and sensed a crackle just under my breastbone. Fear. Burning rage. I poured it all on like lamp oil, ready to ignite. What I needed was to feel something. Something that would make me burn. I pictured my mother's hands curled into claws as she ran at the captain. His sword flashing in the firelight. My name on her lips. She'd needed me. And I had found my fire too late. If only I had known how to control my gift. If only I hadn't used it when she told me not to. It was all my fault. I was responsible for her death and the destruction of my village. I crumpled to my knees, my palms slapping against the flat stone. The memory was like a flame to dry kindling. The heat grew too quickly, out of my control, spitting from my palms and onto the pile and then to my robe, greedily crawling upward until my clothes were completely alight. Although I knew it would take incredible heat to burn fire-blood skin, it felt as if the flames were eating me alive, searing my eyes, stealing the air from my throat, finding the vulnerable places where I might not be as impervious as I'd thought. It was as if I were back in my village again, the torches closing in from every direction with no escape. My fists clenched. Push it away. Control it. Master the fire. But the fire was its own master and wouldn't be ruled. The burning robes tangled around my feet as I clawed at myself, my mouth open in a silent scream. Chapter 4. I was drowning. Strong hands held me in the water, like the soldiers on that day. I bucked and clawed. Muffled curses rained down as I was hauled up and rolled onto soft earth, pinned down by hands on my shoulders and the weight of my own sodden robes. Let me go! I gasped between coughs.
Kindly remove your talons from my arms, said a deep voice.
His hands lifted, shaking off my curled fingers. Arcus turned me onto my side and pounded my back as I coughed out water. As he leaned over me, his hood fell open enough to show a well-shaped nose with a strong bridge and a glimpse of scars on his cheeks. Dimly, I noticed that his skin was smooth where it wasn't scarred. He couldn't be more than a few years older than I. When I could breathe again, I struggled against him.
If you try anything, he warned, I'll put you back in the river. A good dunking will cool that fury. Now, what exactly were you doing out here?
I scooted backward and felt warm rock against my back. Burning my clothes, I said between coughs.
You set fire to your own robes while wearing them, he said doubtfully.
No, I sputtered angrily. My old dress, the one I wore in the prison.
There's a refuse heap just past the stables, Arcas said dryly, nodding to the right. You needn't have started Inferno. Not that I'm against the destruction of those foul rags.
I touched my arms and face, still coughing up bits of river water. My skin was hot, but smooth and unharmed. Relief mixed with embarrassment. I had panicked for no reason, frightened by my own fire. Arcas waved a hand to the tree behind the rock, which was black along its trunk.
I was out walking when I saw a conflagration rise up above the treetops. The fire was clearly out of your control.
I plucked at my robe, cringing away from the cold fabric on my skin. The robes hadn't fared much better than the dress I had come to destroy. It was in blackened tatters, the white linens showing through. Once I might have worried about showing off my underclothes, but Arcas was so stony I doubted he even noticed. I tried not to let my fear of him show. I took a section of what was left of the robe and began wringing it out. I suppose you think I should thank you.
No, he said, his tone stiff. I don't care for gratitude.
How very humble.
Not humble. Gratitude creates a bond that begs further protection or care. I have enough obligations.
You can rest easy, then. I don't need your protection. I have my gift.
A gift that led soldiers to your village.
He'd spoken in neutral tones, but his words pierced the vulnerable places in my mind, where guilt was still naked and fresh.
It was cruelty that led to the destruction of my home. The cruelty of your people with their border wars and raids on villages. Perhaps if the Firebloods had negotiated instead of resorting to assassinations.
Frostblood history, I said with disdain. Forgive me for distrusting your version.
What's your version, then?
My version came from my grandmother, who told me that fire and frost had fought for dominance for as long as anyone could remember. Frostbloods eventually took Tempesia in the north, and Firebloods settled in the Fire Islands of Sedesia. But when the islands had no more land to offer, Firebloods sailed to southern Tempesia and worked for generations to till and improve the soil of the Aris Plains. As their skills grew, they were accepted as valued farmers, until Frostbloods decided they wanted the land for themselves. But history could be twisted and warped to suit the person telling it. I wouldn't convince Arcas of anything, and he, likely, had no trouble painting his own people as rightful rulers and victims of rebel attacks. My gift can heal, I finally said, taking a different approach. Heat has the power to save lives.
It can also ruin them, he replied. It can maim and kill. You burned those soldiers savagely.
I sat forward. Frost can be just as dangerous. Who are you, so perfect and beyond reproach? You haven't even told me what you expect me to do.
He paused. Brother Thistle thought it best to wait before telling you.
Why? He thinks I'm weak like you do.
He shook his head. I knew at the moment I saw that, he gestured to the tree, cloud of fire. Your power is wild, dangerous. Before we can trust you to know more, you need proper training.
And who, pray tell, is going to do that? I'm sure the king has killed all the Fireblood Masters by now.
I had never met a Fireblood Master, of course, but when I was little, Grandmother had told me there was a small handful left in Tempesia. Masters train for years until they have complete control over their gift, and only a Fireblood or Frostblood council of masters can decide if that person has truly done so. Arcus stood and brushed off his robes.
You're right. There are no Fireblood masters left, but there are Frostblood masters. One of them lives in this very abbey and is willing to teach you.
Not you.
No. Brother Thistle. Surely you've noticed the magnitude of his gift.
I had. In the prison, frost had grown wherever he stepped. Even the carriage had crackled with it. And he'd wielded his power with great precision when he'd unlocked my cell. I wanted to learn that kind of control. Supposing I agree, I said, how would he teach me?
You've already agreed, or you wouldn't be here. I'm no teacher. You'll have to ask Brother Thistle about his methods.
I will. Fatigue pulled at my bones. I pushed myself up and started back to the abbey. Arcus caught up with two long strides.
Perhaps with some control you'll be an asset to our plans instead of a danger to yourself.
I'm no danger to anyone but the people who hurt me.
And not much danger to them right now.
I suppose you're an expert in rigid self-control, I said. It must be easy when you're frozen inside.
Those who can't control themselves will find themselves under the control of others. It's a lesson you'd do well to learn.
If you try to control me, it's you who'll be taught a lesson. My foot hit a clod of earth and I stumbled, the ground coming up to meet me. Arcus grabbed the back of my robe and hauled me upright, his derisive snort bringing more heat to my cheeks.
If you wish to threaten me, best wait until you're steadier on your pins.
Before I could protest, he swung me into his arms with ease.
I'm growing accustomed to carrying this bundle of crackling firewood.
Crackling firewood, indeed. No doubt that meant I was skinny and unpleasantly warm. Well, he was intolerably cold. I shuddered against the chill from his chest, resisting the urge to push my way free. That would only reinforce his opinion of my wildness. He took me to the infirmary. I told him to put me on the floor, as I didn't want to soak my palate with my dripping clothes. He set me down quickly, my hip again meeting the floor with a thump. I glared. Perhaps Brother Gamut could teach you how to be gentle, while Brother Thistle teaches me control.
Listen carefully.
He towered over me, his steely tone making me wonder if I'd pushed him too far.
There are rules to your stay here. You may move about freely in the abbey with the exception of the dormers, where the monks sleep.
I snorted. Not somewhere I'm likely to frequent, is it?
In fact, he continued, it would be better if you stayed away from the monks altogether, with the exception of Brother Thistle and Brother Gamut. The rest would just as soon turn you into the soldiers rather than risk bringing them to the abbey, or risk being burned in their beds.
Only if they give me good reason, I replied with sweet poison.
Pay attention, because I'll only say this once. The river is your boundary to the north, the stables to the east, the road to the south, and the edge of the woods to the west. If you pass these boundaries, you'll receive a sound thrashing from me, and you will lose all freedoms and privileges.
You lay one finger on me and I'll...
Burn me so badly, my mistress will run in terror. I'm afraid that threat holds little weight with me, Lady Firebrand. Get yourself dried off before you take ill. You're weak enough as it is.
He walked out and closed the door with a quiet thud, leaving me steaming in my wet robes. Chapter 5. I spent the next 3 days in the infirmary, seeing no one but Brother Gamut and drinking cup after cup of his tea. When resting bored me to distraction, I started a routine of limping around the room at intervals, with breaks in between. It was surprising how quickly I gained strength with the help of Brother Gamut's herbs. For the first time in months, I started to feel safe.
until I woke on the third night with a taste of ashes on my tongue. My fingers dug into the quilt as I tried to shake off images of buildings wreathed in flames. It was just a dream. But the acrid smell wouldn't leave my nose. I sat up, rigid with fear. Fire. I threw on my robe, slammed the door open, and ran as fast as my ankle allowed down the corridor and out through the cloister. Following the haze of smoke, I rounded the northwest corner of the abbey. Brothers and sisters ran from the river to the church, tossing buckets of water at the flames spitting from the north door, their wide-eyed faces and clenched hands appearing white in the firelight. One of the sisters cried out as heat washed over her, the water from her bucket hitting the door with a hiss. Then she wheeled around and ran back toward the river. "Where's Brother Thistle?" I shouted as I drew close. His frost was worth 1,000 pails of river water. One of the monks pointed at a figure stretched out on the ground. I ran over and fell to my knees. Brother Thistle's chest rose and fell too quickly. Brother Gamut shuffled over to us, a bent silhouette against the orange glow. He fell asleep at his desk in the chapter house. Brother Peel found him and carried him out. "We must wake him," I said. "He can put out the fire."
"We've tried. He won't wake."
My heat would hardly help in this situation. I knelt by the monk and gently shook his shoulder. If only I'd some strong-smelling herbs to put under his nose to rouse him. Pounding hoofbeats shook the earth. I turned to see a massive white stallion draw to a halt and Arcus swing from the saddle.
"What did you do?"
he demanded, as he rushed forward and fell to his knees on the other side of Brother Thistle. Shadows hid his expression, but the accusation was clearly directed at me. "I did nothing," I said coldly, "except try to wake him." Brother Gamut cut in to explain what had happened to Brother Thistle. As he spoke, a shout came from one of the sisters who'd been accounting for everyone.
"Sister Pastel isn't here!"
Brother Gamut's hands knotted as he looked at Arcus.
"She must be in the library."
Arcus pushed up and ran for the north door. He blasted the iron door handle with frost and yanked the wooden door open. Smoke billowed out and hungry tongues of flame licked at the edges of the frame. Arcus's whole body was tensed, but he didn't move. Something about his posture reminded me of a small animal facing a predator, its safety dependent on perfect stillness. I left Brother Thistle and ran to Arcus's side.
"What is it?"
He shook his head. "Use your frost to fight the fire as you go," I said, perplexed.
"Is there something wrong? Is your frost not strong enough?"
"Of course it is," he barked. "This is nothing."
He put his hands in front of him. The air crackled with frost, but it melted instantly against the raging heat. My eyes widened as I saw how his arms trembled.
"You're afraid of fire?" I asked, thunderstruck.
He rounded on me with a furious glare, but his breath came in short bursts, his chest rising and falling like he'd just run for miles. I waited to feel triumph at his weakness, but my thoughts were clouded with worry.
"Where's the library?"
"Just past the church," he answered. "Third door."
I nodded. "I need a pathway out. Try your best to clear the hallway, and have Brother Gamut ready to help when I bring Sister..."
"Pastel," he supplied. "But you can't go in. The roof could collapse."
"Then I'll have to get out before it does." I turned and bolted through the doorway and into the church, ignoring Arcus's shouts behind me. A wall of fire blocked the opening to the corridor. I closed my eyes and threw myself through the flames, tumbling onto the stone floor to quench my robes. I opened the third door and found a room lined all around with books. Brushes and pots of ink sat in neat rows on tables in the smoke-filled room. Between two arched windows, there was a tapestry of Tempest, Father of the Four Winds,
whipping up a storm to punish disobedient sailors.
"Sister Pastel!"
I called, my voice shrill. A tall, robed figure was sprawled on the floor beneath the tapestry. I recognized her as the sister who'd eyed me suspiciously as she'd helped bring in my bath the day after I'd come to the abbey. I slid my hands under her arms, grunting with effort as I lifted her. The temperature of her skin was cooler than mine, but nothing like the frigid sting of Arcas's skin. She clearly had no gift of frost to protect her from the flames that filled the corridor. The windows were the only possible exit. I gently set Sister Pastel back down and picked up a wooden chair, smashing it against one of the windows, which shuddered but didn't break. I tried to smash the glass with my shoulder but bounced off, my arms screaming with pain. I fell back a few paces and was about to try again when a low voice called, "Stand away!" I covered Sister Pastel with my robes as best I could and shielded my head with my arms. There was a deafening crash as the beautiful coloured glass exploded inward, spraying vivid shards onto the floor. A rush of fresh air cleared my head as Arcas scrambled over the frame and into the room. I ripped the tapestry from the wall and threw it over the jagged glass. Together, we lifted Sister Pastel over the windowsill and climbed out. As Arcas laid her on a hillock a short distance away, I put my hands on my knees and took great gulps of air, then spun around, heading back to the library. Although my mother had taught me basic letters, it was my grandmother who taught me to read and love books, bringing several volumes whenever she visited, and my mother's compendium of herbs had been invaluable. The thought of all those precious books in the library dissolving into ash was unbearable.
"What are you doing?"
Arcas shouted.
"Saving the books!"
I heard pounding footsteps before he grabbed my shoulders and turned me to face him, a dim outline in the faint glow.
"Leave them! The fire won't spread that far!"
He ran along the abbey wall and I followed. On the north side, the monks kept their vigil with buckets of river water. Arcas told them where he'd left Sister Pastel, then ran to Brother Thistle's side.
"How is he?"
Arcas asked Brother Gamut.
"Still alive,"
the monk answered, looking fretfully toward the roaring fire. Arcas nodded and rushed back to the abbey's large wooden door, the place where he'd looked so lost and frozen only minutes before. The flames belched out brilliant embers that burned to black in the orange light. His brow furrowed as he spread his arms wide and clapped his hands together. Frost crusted over the stone and melted. Another clap, and more melting frost. Arcas fell to his knees in the dirt, his palms slapping the heated ground as his back rose and fell with laboured breaths.
"Just need a minute," he said. "Harder than I expected."
"You're overheated, most likely," I said. "When I'm wet or excessively cold, my gift is weakened. The same must be true for you when your skin is hot. You've been near the fire for too long." He made a non-committal sound. I figured it was as close to agreement as I would get. I waved to a monk who was running forward with a pail of water.
"Wait,"
I called, grabbing the bucket as he slid to a halt. "Bring more water, please. Here, to me." And I turned and dumped the bucket's contents over Arcas. He gasped and shook the water from his hands.
"What are you doing?"
he said, outraged.
"Cooling you off.
Ah, another bucket. Good." I sloshed the pail of river water over his head.
"While I appreciate your help, you don't have to drown me."
"Fine, then you do it." I handed him a third bucket from one of the sisters. Glaring at me, he dumped it over his own head, then moved back in front of the burning doors, clapping his hands and sending out frost. It seemed for a minute that the raging flames would devour the church and the whole abbey with it. But, gradually, the frost stayed for longer and longer on the heated stone. He threw clouds of it whistling down the corridor, and the flames receded, gasping out fat puffs of smoke. In a few minutes, it was done. The fire was out.
A chorus of coughing echoed in the silence. One of the monks fetched a torch from somewhere in the abbey and came to stand near Brother Thistle, along with several others who looked down at him with concern. I stood on the outside of the group, wishing there was more I could do. A man turned to face me, his bushy brows drawn together and his round face twisted in a scowl. I recognized him as the other monk who'd brought my bath the first day, along with Sister Pastel.
"You went right through the fire. You're a fireblood."
My whole body filled with the need to run, get away, all my memories swirling up and closing my throat.
"She's a refugee, Brother Lack," said Arcus, moving from Brother Thistle to where I struggled to stand my ground. "We've offered her a home because hers was destroyed. Her blood is irrelevant."
I looked sharply at Arcus. He was defending me? Brother Lack whirled on him.
"She's a danger to the Abbey and everyone in it."
Each word was delivered with the force of a nail being driven into wood.
"She's a fireblood, and furthermore, a criminal. She had an ankle chain when you first brought her. I saw it myself."
"She is no more a criminal than any of the other hundreds of unfortunate Tempesians who've tried to defend themselves against attacks."
"And what of the king's wrath when our transgression is discovered?"
Brother Lack demanded. A weak voice laced with indignation came from behind him.
"Have you forgotten the aim of our order? To heal the sick and offer refuge to the persecuted?"
We moved to gather around the lean form of Brother Thistle as he raised himself onto one elbow before succumbing to a fit of coughing. Arcus crouched down and took his shoulder gently.
"Easy, my friend. You breathe in a good deal of smoke."
Brother Lack continued to stare at me as if I were a viper about to strike.
"Perhaps she's persecuted for good reason. Perhaps the gods punish her for her sins. I remind you that I come from the south. I've had experiences with firebloods. They are a dangerous, shifty, untrustworthy lot, with no adherence to any of the values we hold dear."
"You forget yourself,"
warned Brother Thistle, breathing heavily, his deceptively soft tone making the hair on my arms stand up.
"Her only sin is being a fireblood, and that is no sin at all."
He coughed a few times more and continued.
"If compassion is so abhorrent to you, perhaps I should question your dedication to the tenets of the order."
"My dedication? I have devoted my life to the order. I only suggest we maintain the purity of this holy place. The fact that you brought a fireblood..."
"And remember,"
Brother Thistle cut in softly,
"I decide who belongs here. The order bestowed that authority on me and no one else."
There was a pregnant pause, full of the sounds of Brother Lack's quickened breathing. A battle of wills waged in stern faces. Finally, his nostrils flared, but he bent his head stiffly.
"Forgive me. I misspoke." "All is forgiven,"
said Brother Thistle, a new series of coughs taking hold of him. Brother Lack raised his head.
"The fact remains. She started a fire that could have killed you."
"It wasn't me," I said, agitated. "What reason would I have to do this?" Arcus considered me silently, and I realized I had plenty of reasons. To distract them so I could run away. To take revenge on Frostbloods. And he'd seen me lose control down by the river when I'd burned my clothes. Some of the other monks muttered to one another, distrust and concern shadowing their faces. Fear and anger pulsed in hot waves from my chest to my fingertips.
"We can debate this for the rest of the night," said Arcus,
speaking loudly over their unrest.
"Meanwhile, your brothers and sisters' injuries go without tending. You have my solemn vow that I will watch the girl closely. We'll discuss this tomorrow."
He spoke with the uncompromising tone of command,
Most of the monks nodded and started to disperse. Brother Lack held his ground, standing with crossed arms and glaring as if I might rush forward and engulf the abbey in flames at any second.
"Follow us," Arcus said to me,
his tone blunt but not hostile.
"Brother Lack, I'll depend on you to see Miss Atrera into the abbey."
He and another monk lifted Brother Thistle. It didn't escape me how carefully Arcus handled him, as if he carried the sleeping form of his own father. There was clear respect, even affection between the two, and the thought made my chest ache with a kind of jealousy. It had been a long time since anyone had treated me with tenderness. They moved along the outside of the abbey, toward the infirmary. I followed slowly, my ankles stiff from exertion and the cold night air. Brother Lack moved to my side, leaning over to mutter in my ear, "You may have Brother Thistle fooled, but I see you for what you are, a vindictive fireblood intent on destroying a place that worships the god of the north wind. I don't know how you wormed your way in here, but I promise you this. I won't rest until you're back in prison where you belong, even if I have to take you there myself." The bright intensity of his small black eyes showed that he was dangerously sincere. What would it take? One simple message alerting the soldiers to my presence. Or perhaps one night I'd find myself hauled from my bed and shoved into a carriage bound for the nearest garrison. I had made a mistake of letting relief convince me I was safe here. I would never be safe with followers of Force. I had to remember that. Arcus appeared in the doorway to the abbey.
"Inside," he commanded.
There was no more time to hesitate or wait for my body to heal. Any fate was better than finding myself back in prison. I would leave tonight. Chapter 6. The infirmary was quiet, a thick, cloying silence that makes you fancy you can hear impossible things, like a spider's progress over the windowsill, or the swish of a mouse's tail dragging on the floor in the dark. I lay on my usual cot, pretending to be asleep, while Brother Thistle and Sister Pastel slumbered in adjacent cots. Arcus had chosen the mattress closest to the door, a shadow guarding the abbey from my dangerous presence. At first, I'd feared that Arcus planned to keep awake all night to watch me, but after giving me a stony look and ordering me to sleep, he settled down on his bed. He gave no indication whether he was grateful for my help saving Sister Pastel, or whether he believed I had started the fire in the first place. Perhaps, at that moment, he didn't care. He'd moved slowly, and seemed very tired, as if the effort of putting out the fire had taken every scrap of strength from his body. When everyone's breathing was slow and even, with only a rattling cough occasionally breaking the silence, I picked up a pair of leather boots that sat discarded by Brother Thistle's feet, which weren't that much bigger than my own. I took a thick cloak that hung on a peg on the wall and crept barefoot to the door. As I turned the knob, it creaked slightly. I froze and glanced sharply at Arcus's solid bulk. He slept on his side, his hood still firmly covering half of his face. Was that a slight hitch in his breathing? I waited, silent and breathless. Finally, when he didn't move, I turned the knob and opened the door. I felt my way in the silken dark to the arched eastern door of the abbey before putting on the boots, then crunched over the frozen ground to the kitchen, where I found a leather satchel and filled it with apples, hard cheese, a bit of dried meat, a few nuts and seeds, a sharp wooden-handled knife, and a water skin. I knew from Brother Gamut that a small room adjacent to the kitchen served as an apothecary, where he dried and ground his herbs. Glass bottles lined the shelves. Inspecting each label, I chose the ones I thought most valuable. If the abbey had any silver or gold adornments, candlesticks and such,
I would have taken those instead. But I hadn't seen anything worth stealing. I found a second leather bag and filled it to bursting with glass bottles, careful to wrap each in linen bandages. When I reached the stables, the horses grew agitated, perhaps still unsettled by the smoke that lingered in the air from the church fire. One of them was Arcas's massive, fiercely elegant white stallion. He snorted and stamped and rolled his glinting eyes at me. Instead, I approached a yellow-coated mare that greeted me with a blink of her soft brown eyes. I stroked the space between them, and was relieved when she didn't shy away from my heat. In minutes, I had her saddled. We left the stables and rode west. As the mare proved steady and I found my seat, I lengthened the reins, the muscles of her back rippling. A sensation of freedom shot through me, heady and wonderful, and I squeezed my legs tighter, eliciting a burst of speed from the mare's flanks. Every breath exploded in my ears as I waited for a shout from behind me or the jolt of hooves clattering across the forest floor. But then I crossed the western boundary Arcas had set, and the quiet woods folded around me like the arms of an old friend. The mare found a path through tall, fragrant pines and leafless oak and sycamore trees, and I let her follow it. I would find a port city where I would sneak onto a ship. Tevros was northwest of Tempesia, but I wasn't sure how far or where it was from here. As I considered which direction to go, my stomach rumbled out a reminder of a more immediate problem. I leaned over to check on the leather satchel that held the food, and cursed. It wasn't there. It must have become dislodged when I'd let the mare gallop, and would be too hard to find in the dark. I struggled not to panic. If I had better control of my gift, I could use it to hunt, to roast a squirrel or winter hare where it stood. But that kind of deliberate use was well beyond me. I'd have more luck making a trap, but I had no knife to cut twigs or branches, as it was in the same satchel as the food. I could only hope the path led to a village. Rather than riding into a gorge, we stopped for the night under a canopy of pines. The next morning, I watched the sunrise paint the mare in streaks of gold, like butter melting on a soft piece of freshly baked bread. "I'm going to call you Butter," I told the horse with a pat. She snorted softly in reply. While Butter ate withered grasses, which I hoped wouldn't make her ill, I gathered some edible roots for a meagre meal. My throat was parched with thirst, but there was no sign of water until the afternoon of the second day, when a distant rushing noise brought Butter's ears up. A lively river churned over rocks. After drinking our fill, we followed the river's course until it veered over a cliff. From there, we turned south, and found path after winding path as the sun set again. It was eerily quiet. An acrid, burning smell tainted the clean forest air. It wasn't the smell of freshly burning wood, but the stale echo of things burned and left to decay. We came upon a maze of wooden buildings, houses and shops that were broken and charred and caving in on themselves. Soldiers had been here. I barely breathed. If there was even a chance that they waited anywhere nearby, we would turn and leave as swiftly as we could. But I couldn't afford to pass up the possibility of food if any was left in some abandoned larder. I was already weak with hunger, and it was clear the village was abandoned. One of the houses was less damaged than the rest. Inside, I found turnips, a few potatoes, a half-melted round of cheese, worth its weight in gold to my ravenous eyes, and a metal flask. I gathered it all quickly and remounted Butter, riding for another hour before resting. The next day, we found a thin stream covered in ice. I broke the surface and filled my flask. I ate the cheese, but the turnips and potatoes were too hard and would need cooking to be edible. There was little shelter on the next stretch of rocky land, so we kept on without resting until night fell. I was a jumble of aches and bruises, barely upright on the horse's back by the time lights flickered on in the distance, appearing and disappearing between the trees like playful spirits. The trees gave way to a clearing, where a dozen wagons were arranged in circles around campfires. I halted and slid off the horse's back in the cover of the pine boughs, well out of the firelight. People were sitting in clusters, turning spits made of tree branches. My mouth watered as the juices from a skinned hare dripped into the fire with a hiss. They divided the rich-smelling meat into portions, but, to my frustration, they didn't take out sleeping rolls or retire for the night in their wagons after eating. Instead, they gathered at the center of the clearing, jostling for the best seat on one of the fallen logs that had been pulled into a semicircle around a fire. A woman with chestnut hair, her face carved in strong, striking lines, came forward and invited a girl of about 9 or 10 years old to choose a tale. I sat on the ground on a bed of pine needles, my back against a tree trunk. Butter stood a few yards behind me, content to rest. The girl chose the origin story, how the Frostbloods and Firebloods came to be. With her hands in her lap, the old woman seemed to grow taller and statelier in the dancing orange light. All faces leaned toward her, their excitement palpable as they listened. "In the early days," said the storyteller, in her low, melodious voice, "people had no frost or fire. They lived with the animals, wearing the skins of those they hunted, and were barely more than animals themselves. The gods of the four winds lived in the sky, each keeping to their own kingdoms, isolated but equal. Only Fors, the god of the north wind, was lonely. He wanted there to be someone like him, someone who reveled in blistering cold and biting ice." Her hands moved like white birds among the flickering shadows. "So he swept his hand to the glacier at the top of the world and gathered the coldest pieces. Then he shrank himself into human form and watched the human tribes as they warred with one another, endlessly killing and being killed."
"How were they killed, Magla?"
asked a girl in a fascinated whisper.
"Katrin," said her mother. "Don't ask such morbid questions."
Magra smiled and leaned close, as if she was familiar with the girl's thirst for gory details.
"Any way you can think of. By their own hands, by stones and swords and axes."
"I bet it was terrible," the girl said with delight.
The storyteller nodded.
"Fors said to the woman who ruled the tribes of the north, 'Here, take my ice and use it to freeze your enemies. Then no one will be able to defeat you.' He put the shard of ice into her wrist, and the vein turned blue. The woman's body became cold, and her eyes turned pale. She raised her hand and smote the enemy tribesmen with deadly showers of frost and snow, until everyone who was left ran from her in terror."
The girl clapped her hands, and some boys inched forward on the ground, their eyes bright in the firelight. Even the adults were still and silent, their gazes rapt.
"But Sood," said Magra with a stern look, "the goddess of the south wind, had loved a warrior of the defeated tribe, and it pierced her heart to watch him die. She saw how formidable the icy warrior woman had become, and was afraid that she would kill all the other tribes."
Magra put out her fist as if she were holding something.
"So Sood swept her hand into the great volcano, pulling out drops of bubbling lava. Then she shrank herself into human form and watched the people as they struggled to find food and to keep themselves safe from the ice tribe."
She opened her hand and spread her fingers, as if she were bestowing a gift.
"Here," the goddess said to a chieftain, who ruled a tribe in the desert, "take this lava and use it to melt the ice of your enemies. Whoever defies you shall be burned. Then you will need to fight no more." She put the drop of lava into the wrist of the chieftain, and the vein bubbled hot. The man's body warmed, and his hair turned red. He raised his hand and cast fire at all his enemies, and no one dared defy him. Magra made a sweeping gesture, her long sleeve billowing out, and the children shrank back as if fire might spring from her fingers. Over time, the other tribes made alliances with Frost or Fire, the Fireblood and Frostbird leaders having reached a truce. Each claimed their lands on the earth. Maps were drawn and the people found peace. She paused as if that were the end of her story, and the listeners seemed to hold their breath. But Eurus, god of the East Wind, was filled with envy. He went to Neb, the mother of the winds, to complain. He wanted to create his own creature. Neb was tired of her children fighting, so she declared there must be balance in all things. Whatever Eurus made, his sister Cirrus, goddess of the West Wind, would have to make the opposite. She held her hands palms up, as if they formed two sides of a scale. Eurus, excited and filled with purpose, swept his hand into the depths of the ocean, down, down to the darkest shadows in the deepest caves. He pulled out a handful of absolute darkness. Then, sure that he'd found the best gift of all, shrank himself into human form and watched the tribes as they struggled under the rule of Frost and Fire. "Here," he said to a powerful shaman, "take this darkness and use it to erase all of your suffering. You'll never feel pain again." He put the darkness into the man's wrist, and the vein turned black. But instead of finding relief, the man fell to the ground, writhing in pain and begging for mercy. In minutes, he was dead. The eyes of the younger boys grew round. Katrin leaned forward. "Eurus tried over and over again, but no one could survive his sweet oblivion. So the god of the East Wind divided and sprinkled his darkness over the world, and wherever it fell, a shadow came to life." She lowered her voice until it was eerie and soft. Fine hairs rose on the back of my neck. "But the shadows were hungry. They devoured the animals and people and were never satisfied. And if a shadow, called a Minax, took a special liking to you, it would seep beneath your skin, turn in your eyes and your blood black. You'd become vicious and wild, cunning and bloodthirsty, eager to do its bidding and lose yourself in its blissful darkness." I rubbed the back of my neck with my hand, trying to erase the chill that danced down my spine. From the day I'd been taken to Black Creek Prison, I'd had nightmares about a living shadow. The most frightening part of the old stories preying on my fear and isolation. In the dreams, a dark shape would touch my cheek in a painful, blistering caress. I'd wake up shaken and terrified. "It was a dark time," said the storyteller, "but the creatures weren't allowed to roam free for long. Cirrus, the goddess of the West Wind, who loved peace above all things, made a hole in the earth. She forced the living shadows into the darkness below and created a gate of light at the entrance, which the Minax couldn't pass through." Magra opened her hand to the sky. Then Cirrus swept her hand into the vivid sunset and snatched a ray of light, which she trapped in a crystal. She shone the light onto two mountains, changing them into sentinels, and putting them to sleep until called on to guard the gate if it ever fell under attack. Finally, she called the fiery chieftain and the icy warrior woman and commanded them to mix their frost and fire to help her seal the gate. "I bet they fought," said one of the boys. "No, they didn't," Magra said. "They worked together because that was what the goddess wanted." Exhausted from her labours, she fell to earth. A wise woman called Sage took Cirrus to her mountain cave and fed her broth and meat, and nursed her back to health. In gratitude, Cirrus put the last bit of sunset from the crystal into Sage's wrist, turning her blood and hair to gold. After that, she could heal the sick and see danger before it happened. She is the third sentinel guarding the Gate of Light, and she won't die until the last Minax is destroyed.
But the shadows are all trapped underground, Catrin said.
Ah, some say Eurus kept two of his favorite creations on the earth by hiding them where no one would find them. So Sage must keep watch until they are destroyed as well. Magra put her hands in her lap and sat back. But the world has grown weary of stories now, she said, slowing her voice to signal the end of the story. And only children listen. Memory shuddered through me. My grandmother had always ended her origin story with the same phrase.
I'll always listen to the stories, said Catrin. And then I'll tell them to the others on my adventures across the sea, to the Fire Islands of Sudesia, and to the west, where there are monsters, and then I'm going to get a sword and...
Mom says you're too sick to travel, said one of the boys.
My eyes flicked to Catrin. She didn't look ill, though her cheeks were a little flushed.
I'm going to get better, she said angrily. I'm going to find somewhere with no soldiers and no bad people and a king who isn't mad.
Her mother's eyes widened. The circle of listeners were silent.
Hush, child, said a man in a low voice.
I don't care, said Catrin, but more quietly. His soldiers burned our homes.
They burned my village too, I said in a whisper, so soft even I could barely hear it.
It's time for bed, you little ones,
said Catrin's mother, taking the hand of each child. We travel again tomorrow. In 2 days we'll reach the coast. You need your rest. So the coast was only 2 days away. Perhaps I could follow in their wake, stealing food at night and using their path to find my way safely down the mountain. One by one, the fires were extinguished, and everyone shuffled off to the wagons. Unfortunately for my hopes of pilfering food, a tall, bearded man remained as sentry, leaning his back against a wagon as he took a swig from a flask. After a while, another man joined the first. He wore a patch of dark fabric over one eye.
"Anything?"
he asked, pulling his rumpled cloak more tightly around himself.
"Unlikely," the bearded man answered. "The soldiers moved on. The Fireblood is halfway across the sea, if she has any sense. If not, they'll run her to ground between here and the coast."
I sucked in a breath as my heart took up an irregular beat. I wasn't sure how many other Firebloods were out there, but I had to assume they were talking about me. The man with the eye patch hacked and spat on the ground.
"That's what I think of that stinking Fireblood. She escapes from prison and we all suffer for it."
I clamped my hand over my mouth.
"They say Firebloods are the dangerous ones, but I don't see none of them burning down my house."
"We'll go back in the summer," said the bearded man. "Though I wonder what's the point of rebuilding when they can take it all away again. Only the injured and ill left to defend our homes." The other man scoffed.
"No doubt they'll soon decide we're fit enough. Never mind this," he pointed to his eye patch, "or your tree branch of a leg. Fat lot of good we were when they raided us."
The bearded man sighed. "They still don't sleep nights, thinking about a Fireblood wandering free with fire in her fingertips." "I'm not a threat." I wanted to scream it so loudly that they would somehow believe that it was true. The Frostblood soldiers were the threat. That captain who killed my mother, cutting her down like she was nothing. "The reward, though. 5,000 coin. Think of it." The bearded man gestured with his flask, pointing it to the right. "I could hire a ship bound east, buy some land on some empty island, build a house, find a cure for Catrin." The man with the eye patch put a hand on the other man's shoulder.
The healer in Tevros will fix her up right enough. You'll see.
The bearded man handed over his flask.
Take the watch, he said,
limping stiffly to one of the wagons.
5,000.
I moved deeper into the trees, struggling to muffle my gasping breaths. I would never be safe. The soldiers were so close, raiding the countryside in search of... It could only be me. If I followed the villagers to the coast and we hit a stretch of open ground, I'd be easily spotted. Then again, with the twisting, tree-lined mountain paths, there was usually somewhere to hide. A chorus of coughing pierced my fog of indecision. It was a child's cough, and it came from the clearing. I moved closer until I could see. The bearded man with a limp carried a small form, while a woman followed closely behind.
"Magra," said the man, pounding on the side of one of the wagons. "Please help us. Katrin is having another spell."
The storyteller came out, shivering in the cool air.
"I don't know what else we can do. All the herbs perished in the fire, and even if I had my cures, I tried everything. But it's so much worse now."
The woman who must be Katrin's mother twisted her hands together.
"She breathed in the smoke, and it was already bad enough. It's been such a wet winter."
She took a shuddering breath.
"You must be able to do something." "The only thing we can do is keep her as warm as possible,"
Magra replied gently. The girl was coughing so hard she could barely draw breath. Her mother started crying in stifled sobs, trying to block them with a fist. I tried to think of what Mother would do. It was a wet cough, not a dry one. That rolled out steam infused with the essence of needleflower or nightbrace. I'd have to feel her skin to know if she had a fever, and I couldn't do that without revealing myself. But I could judge by the sound. I ran through all of Mother's patients in my mind until I remembered one whose cough had sounded similar. It had been a boy a few years older than I, with racking coughs so severe he had started bringing up blood. She had used some kind of tincture on his chest. I closed my eyes and tried to remember. Eggswort. No, that was red and the tincture had been yellow. I could almost picture her hands as she crushed the herbs. Suddenly, it came to me. "Essence of wintergreen and spiny meadow veil," I whispered. I crept back to the saddlebag, patting Butter as she gave a soft wicker, and rummaged through until I found the bottles I'd snatched from Brother Gamut's apothecary. It took several minutes of unstopping each and sniffing carefully, but I found the two I needed. Clutching them tightly, I hovered near the edge of the trees. Someone had fed and stoked the campfire. The man with the limp sat with Katrin close to his chest, a blanket wrapped around her small frame. He patted her back gently while the girl's mother stroked her toffee blonde hair. It made my chest ache. My mother would have done the same thing, hovered over me, done anything she could for me. She had done that. Her whole life had been about protecting me. And to see this spirited little girl who had vowed to sail the oceans, struggling even to draw breath, I knew I wouldn't be able to leave things be. I had to help. After a few minutes, the girl's coughing eased.
"Best stay close to the fire," said the mother.
"Too cold in the wagon." The man nodded, and they huddled together, adjusting position a few times before their breathing changed and it was clear they'd fallen asleep. It would be near impossible to get close without waking them. I went back to Butter and riffled through the saddlebag again, this time searching the bottles by size. It was the smallest I wanted, the one that was carefully labelled as producing a deep sleep from one drop of its fumes. I wondered if Brother Thistle had used this concoction to subdue the guards in the prison. Once I found the tiny bottle, I moved behind the wagon where the man with the eye patch stood watching Katrin and her parents with a somber expression. I put a drop of potion on the edge.